You're listening to a message delivered at the Fountains, a United Methodist Church in Fountain Hills, Arizona.
Today's readings from Genesis are excerpts from one of the great works of ancient literature, the story of Noah. While we don't have time to read the entire story, essentially Genesis 6 through 9, we do have time to read enough to make you go, huh? And that'll suffice. The two paragraphs you're about to hear are both in Genesis, side by side, but because of cultural conditioning, your brain has actively shut out one of these passages. So listen carefully to the details, and what you'll hear are two very different accounts of the same event by two different sources. These authors have come to be called the Yahwist and the Priestly Authors, or J and P for short. And they're intertwined throughout Genesis 6 through 9, but they offer wildly different accounts. For example, in J, it rains for 40 days and 40 nights, and then takes 21 days for the waters to recede. But in the P version, it rains for 150 days, and the waters are on the ground for a year and 11 days. Now, if you've read the account of the flood and didn't notice this conflict, don't be dismayed. Almost everyone misses it until someone points it out. We're programmed to miss it because we know how the story goes from when we were 6 years old. We know the truth, and anyone who says otherwise is up to no good and needs to be called out as wrong, right?
Our words of wisdom are from Genesis chapter 6, verses 19 and 20, and Genesis chapter 7, verses 2 and 3.
Genesis 6, and of every living thing, of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark, and keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds according to their kinds, and of the animals according to their kinds, of every creeping thing on the ground according to its kind, two of every kind shall come into you to keep them alive.
And from Genesis 7, take you with you seven pairs of all clean animals, the male and its mate, and a pair of animals that are not clean, the male and its mate, and seven pairs of birds of the air also, male and female, to keep their kind alive on the face of all the earth.
Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
So, what's it going to be? Did the animals assemble two by two or seven by seven? The Bible clearly says it's both. But that can't be right, can it? Which version would you defend? Your answer will determine whether you're part of the problem or part of the solution to the crisis tearing our culture apart. Here's the challenge. As many American Christians grow up, they are taught and expected to believe that biblical stories are historically and factually accurate. In fact, many church websites trumpet their belief in the inerrancy of Scripture and the grave consequences of questioning any element of the Bible. So, despite the impossible scientific logistics and the appalling genocidal theology, the latest polling suggests that approximately 60% of Americans believe that the biblical story of Noah's flood is an historical, factual account. Every day, countless Christians, and not just fundamentalists, congratulate themselves for being able to suspend disbelief and embrace the divine wisdom of an all-loving and gracious God committing the kind of global genocide that would make a Nazi blush. And if you don't think this slops over into real-world consequences, let me point out to you that our new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, is one of these people who is untethered from reality. He provided enthusiastic legal counsel to Ken Ham's Ark Encounter, successfully securing major tax breaks to build a full-size Ark replica in the Kentucky countryside. Also, just this week, I saw several articles pop up online claiming that archaeologists in Turkey, who, surprise, turn out to be fundamentalist Christians, have unearthed what they believe could be the remains of the real Noah's Ark. Several of the articles even appeared in those bastions of biblical archaeology, Popular Mechanics, and the New York Post. Never mind that for over 50 years, 99.999% of archaeologists have said over and over again that the so-called Durupinar Formation is not the result of a petrified shipwreck, but is a natural rock formation, or that there is absolutely no geologic record of a global flood to begin with, or that, as we heard in our passages today, the Bible itself has two contradictory stories of the flood that were never meant to be taken as fact. None of that matters, because people are going to believe what they learned when they were 6 years old and are not going to be swayed by the facts. And just to stay in the realm of current events, let's consider the war in the Middle East. Let me be clear. I am appalled at and condemn the acts of terrorism perpetrated on innocent Israelis by Hamas in October. But I'm also troubled by what, by any measure, is an excessive use of retaliatory force being visited upon innocent civilians in Gaza. And one of the most oft-heard justifications for the Israeli government's unbridled response is the belief of some that they were literally given the land by God himself. And where does that belief come from? From the biblical promise to Abraham and the story of Moses. God leading the Israelites out of Egypt, across the Jordan River, and into the land of milk and honey, now being fought over by Israelis and Palestinians. But here's the rub. The Exodus never happened. Jewish slaves did not build the pyramids. There's absolutely no archaeological evidence for the ancestors of the Jews having ever lived in Egypt, let alone traipsing across the Sinai and returning to Jerusalem. And go ahead, ask any non-fundamentalist rabbi, and they'll tell you. These are good stories, but not fact. So, just like Christian pastors hesitant to talk about the resurrection being metaphor and not literal fact, they might hesitate to talk about it openly. Why? Because, as Andy Rooney said, people will generally accept facts as truth only if the facts agree with what they already believe. Look, people have invested so much in believing these stories to be factually true, they just can't bring themselves to seeing them any other way. Even though, like Noah's 2x2 or 7x7, the Bible itself doesn't support their obsession with making the fanciful factual. Blogging on Patheos, Baptist pastor Chuck Queen writes that fundamentalism feeds and grows on the gullibility of people to believe what they want to believe. It thrives on the propagation of beliefs that defy logic, reason, science, and common sense, but somehow appeal to our lower instincts and passions. While many Catholics and mainline Protestants have taken the last 150 years of expert biblical and theological scholarship to heart, fundamentalists have proudly embraced the rejection of science and rational thought as a badge of honor in order to defend a literal six-day creation, intelligent design, Jesus' literal virgin birth and his physical resurrection. They have created a whole alternative universe they call a, quote, biblical worldview, unquote. So, having been marinated in this alternative, fact-free perspective for generations, is it any wonder that they then are the first to be taken in by those recent additions to our political lives, alternative facts, fake news, and the incredibly bizarre fantasy world of QAnon? You heard me. Our current national nightmare of grievance politics, Christian nationalism, and scorched earth partisan political standoffs comes to you courtesy of, that's right, Christianity, and a particularly toxic version at that. In analyzing people's susceptibility to fake news, writer Christopher Douglas notes that Americans' tendency to embrace alternative facts and reject anything they don't understand as fake has its historical origin in Christian fundamentalism's rejection of facts in general and of expert elites in particular. One of the principal methods utilized by the church is also at the heart of any good propaganda effort. It's called the illusion of truth effect, also known as the reiteration effect. It leverages people's tendency to believe false information as correct after repeated exposure. Napoleon reportedly said that there is only one figure in rhetoric of serious importance, namely repetition. This has been honed into an art form by our former president, who has clearly espoused the strategy of, as long as you keep repeating something, it doesn't matter what you say, they'll believe it. And what we've learned is that if this horse has already left the barn, you're in big trouble. As Winston Churchill said, a lie gets halfway around the world before the truth has a chance to get its pants on. So what to do? The first thing may be the hardest task of all, and that is to be reconciled to the fact that many in our culture have not only been conditioned by their Christian upbringing to reject facts, but praised for rejecting facts, despite the evidence. In order to belong, conventional Christians are taught that it is a virtue to believe unbelievable things, that it is appropriate to project their superiority over others, and that harming or diminishing those who are not like us or who don't believe as we do is a demonstration of faith. On the other hand, one of the primary characteristics of a more progressive perspective is to reject black and white thinking and be open to new possibilities. And the good news is that the Bible supports that same perspective. We see it in our passages today. The animals parading into the ark, both 2x2 and 7x7. Well, it can't be both. Why not? Haven't you ever heard the expression, two Jews, three opinions? That's why there are two flood stories, two creation stories, two Exodus stories, and on and on, none of which agree with each other on the details. They're not supposed to be history. They're stories told to generate dialogue and conversation, not lay out the facts. Then it's in the conversation, it's in the give and take, where we have the opportunity to establish what things mean, what is true and best for us as a community. It's the same with our Christian tradition. There are two very different birth narratives in our Gospels, neither of which agrees on anything other than Jesus having been born. The Synoptic Gospels and the Gospel of John don't agree on anything. And there are no less than four different versions of Jesus' death and resurrection that don't agree on order of events, characters, or dialogue. Does that mean the Bible is lying? No. It means that at least four different authors did their very best to convey what Jesus meant to their communities, and the early church was wise enough to include all four versions, despite the contradictions. The rest is up to us to figure out in dialogue with one another. And this is where we have our opportunity. Our challenge is to not fall into the trap of black and white dualistic thinking that sets up adversarial relationships. Instead, we have the opportunity to transcend our primal us versus them mentality. And let's be real, we are not going to argue a fundamentalist Christian into changing their beliefs. But we can find common ground in asking just one question. What does this story mean? Let's leave behind any arguments over whether this or that happened this or that way. What does it mean for you, for me, for our relationship? In the case of our passages today, the differences are there for a theological reason. It was important for the priestly author to include seven pairs of clean animals because in the priestly telling of the story, the first thing Noah does when he disembarks, is to offer an animal sacrifice to God. And if he wanted to do that, he'd better have more than just one pair of each species. Otherwise, whoops, extinction. So, what are the priorities of each one of these authors? What were they trying to say to their original audience? And what of that message has any bearing on our lives today? Even saying to someone, you know, there's another way of looking at that, may be too uncomfortable a conversation with significant others in our lives. But asking, tell me what that passage means, can open up one-on-one dialogue in relationships of trust and diffuse the you're wrong and I'm right kind of confrontation. Look, is there a single major crisis in the world right now that doesn't have, at least in one significant way, its roots in religion? Religion drives people crazy. But as that great theologian Sting reminds us, people go crazy in congregations. They only get better one by one. And that's our fix, to be in conversation with people one by one about meaning, not about what they're supposed to believe or whether this or that actually happened or not. What do you think this story means? And in the conversation, we start to build trust and plant the seeds of healing. Many years ago, the emperor of China was getting old and had no male heir. He'd always loved gardening and devised a plan to pass the role of emperor onto whichever boy could grow the most beautiful and beneficial plant. The one catch was that the emperor would provide the seeds. The word went out, and boys flocked to the palace for the seeds. Among them was a boy who, despite carefully planting his seed in rich soil, watering it and caring for it, nothing happened. All around him, the seeds planted by other boys quickly sprouted and grew. They laughed and taunted the boy with the barren pot. He tried replanting it. He tried new fertilizer, more sun, but nothing worked. Finally, the day came to take the plants to the emperor. Despondent, the boy took his empty pot to the palace in hopes of there being at least some sort of consolation prize. The emperor examined the other boy's vital green plants with a scowl on his face and frowned even more when he saw the empty pot. "You brought me an empty pot?" the emperor asked. Hanging his head, the boy said, "I'm sorry, emperor. I tried and tried to grow the seed you gave me, but nothing came up." The emperor stroked his chin and smiled. Turning to the crowd, he said, "I'd like to introduce you to the new emperor. You see, the seeds I gave out were cooked, so they would not grow. I'm not sure how the rest of you grew plants, but they didn't grow from my seeds. Only this boy has been honest and brave enough to be so." Friends, we need to be brave enough to be honest, even when the seeds we plant don't seem to go anywhere, especially when the alternative facts and fake news seems to have the advantage. The folks we are called to be in dialogue with are not stupid. They've just been conditioned to embrace a kind of black and white dualism that not even the Bible supports. And if we make it all about convincing others that we're right and they're wrong, we'll get nowhere. What's needed is honest conversation, one-on-one. As a pastor, I can talk until I'm blue in the face. But in the final analysis, it's you who will ultimately change people's perspectives by how you live, how you treat others, and by not being afraid to ask, "What does this story mean to you?" You might even be able to work your way up to saying, "You know, there is another way of looking at this, be it LGBTQ rights, women's reproductive rights, fostering interfaith respect, or any number of other issues in life." Simply be who you are, where you are on the spiritual journey. Put love first in your own way. Don't give in to the tribal impulse to prove others wrong and yourself right, or feel despondent because your efforts aren't as flashy as those who promote a different take on things. Remember, the conventional outlook is just too comfortable and seductive for most people to resist without someone like you, someone they know and trust, to be brave enough to be in dialogue with them. So just be honest. And with all the frustrations and seeming lack of success you'll experience, and take it from someone who knows, you will have a lack of success. Despite all of that, one or two people along the way will get it. Then it'll be maybe 2 by 2, then 7 by 7. And then who's to say what part you will end up having played in transforming the world? Be well.
Thanks for listening to this week's Applying It to Life from the Fountains. For more information or to support this outreach with a donation, visit www.weputlovefirst.org.